Our dear brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ, I want to spend just a few moments before dealing with the ecclesia at Ephesus proper by looking at the establishment and the background to the formation of the ecclesia. And we find that
we all have problems and difficulties in our lives in the truth. We may have problems in marriage or out of marriage, problems through illness, through mourning, through sadness, through unemployment, even through employment, pressures at work, college, school, at home, worry, the stress of everyday life. And sometimes it's hard when we come to the word of exhortation to say, well, we should put all that behind us and forget it and look to that glorious hope that we have for the future. We are meant to remember one who endured the contradiction of sinners, one who was perfect in all ways. And what I want to do, brothers and sisters, is to consider the servant Job, a brother who went through so much, and by considering him, to consider ourselves and that which we endure, and at the same time to look to that perfect example of that one through whom we can be washed, one through whom we can be cleansed of our sin. James chapter 5 provides a background then to our brother James. James chapter 5 and verse 7. Words that are so apt for us in these last days. Be patient, therefore, says James, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. The husbandman doesn't have the produce instantly. He has to wait and be patient. There has to be that time of waiting and longing. Therefore James says in verse 8, be ye also patient, establish your heart, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. The Revised Version is at hand. Grudge not, or murmur not, one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Take, my brethren, the prophets, who have spoken in the name of the Lord, for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. You see, brothers and sisters, the suffering of affliction and the patience come together. And therefore it is only through affliction that we can achieve the patience that the Father requires of us. Behold, we count them happy which endure. And if, brothers and sisters, we were to list the prophets and to find one that we might take as an example, we may as well have not taken the one that James does in verse 11. For he says, behold, we count them happy or blessed which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. So James goes back to Job and says, you can consider Job, you can consider his afflictions, you can consider his suffering, you can consider his patience, and more than that, you can actually see the end result. You can see the blessing that the Father gives to him at the end, and that proves that God is full of mercy and is pitiful. And that will help us to endure, which is what the word patience means, to the coming of the Lord. We might consider that our problems are worse than the problems that Job had to endure. We might even say it was easier for Job because he could talk to God, and we don't get that instant rapport, that instant conversation with the Father. And we might want to push our problems aside and perhaps ignore them, but if we face them, brothers and sisters, and consider them through the word of exhortation, then hopefully we too will be strengthened by that which Job did. The question is, how could Job show that patience? Let's go to the book of Job. We've been reading there of the life that he had to endure. And it's a long book. It's a long book that shows us the heart and the mind. It shows us the questioning. And yet we know that in all this, Job sinned not, we are told. And it's there to encourage us and to help us. Not that we might point the finger at him or anyone else in the book. We're introduced to him then in verse 1 as a man who was in the land of Uz, and a description is given to him. This is not a description by man, but a description by the Father of what he saw in this man, Job. For Job, we read in Job 1, verse 1, was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. That summary, brothers and sisters, is God's judgment upon this man. I wonder where we come then, brothers and sisters, as we meet together to remember another that was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. What about the measure of the man of Christ in us, brothers and sisters, that one to whom we should attain? In verse 2, we are introduced to his family, 7 sons and 3 daughters, and of course the wife that we read of. This was his family then, 7 sons and 3 daughters and a wife, all of whom he loved. In verse 3, we are introduced to his estate, his wealth, and his employment. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 1,000 oxen, and 500 she-asses. 11,500 creatures that belonged to him. We read in that verse also of his title, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. And that's God's description again of him. So the inspired record then builds up a picture of this man, a man of greatness in the earth, but more especially a man who showed this perfect and upright character that was required by the Eternal Father. And with all those riches, with all the trials and temptations that must have gone with those riches, and with the blessing of that large family, he still feared God and was perfect and upright. Verse 5. It was so when the days of the feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed or renounced God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. So Job was not a father who didn't care and love his children, but one who offered sacrifices on behalf of his sons in case they had sinned in their hearts. In verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan came also amongst them. And Yahweh said unto Satan, whence comest thou? And Satan's answer is, from going to and fro in the earth, from walking up and down in it. And the Father then turns and asks Satan to consider, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and discheweth evil. I think it's important, brothers and sisters, sometimes when considering Job, that we realise that it was the Father who first points to Job and asks Satan to consider him. And it is Satan's reaction that is talked of throughout this book, as Satan now refuses to accept that this man is perfect and upright before God. We too are met together to present ourselves before the Father as the sons and daughters of the living God through the covenant that he has made, through that special sacrifice and that special relationship that through the waters of baptism we now have. We too present ourselves before the Father. And what of our judgment, of our thoughts concerning our brethren and sisters? We are met to consider the Son of God, who was perfect, who was tempted and tried in all points like as we are, and yet without sin. What effect does it have upon us, brothers and sisters? Does it affect us so much that we look to ourselves to change our way of life? What was Satan's reaction then, verse 9, when he was asked to consider? He says, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him, and about his house, and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. God doesn't fear you, Job doesn't fear you for nothing, says Satan. And it was true, was it not, that the angel of Yahweh encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. It was true that the Father would look after Job, for he was a faithful man, a faithful servant. The Father had edged about and protected him through his Elohim. He would bless the work of his hands, for he was a faithful man. And Satan misunderstood that. So much so that in verse 11, he says, "But put forth now thine hand, and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face." Yahweh said unto Satan, "Behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon thyself put not forth thine hand." Satan is of course not given literally power. That expression there where it says that he's in thy power, it's used in the book of Genesis when Abraham says to Sarah that he will put Hagar into her hand, the same idea that she was to decide what would happen to Hagar. So Satan now can choose what will happen to Job, and the Father, as we know, will perform it. It's the flesh, is it not, brothers and sisters? And it's in each one of us to point the finger at others and to say that it's easier for them because. Easier because they have more money, they have a family, or they don't have a family, or their parents or their family were in the truth, or they're not in the truth. It's very easy to point the finger and say it's easier for them. And yet Satan would have to learn the lesson. Because as a result of Satan's lack of faith, as a result of his judgment upon his brother, verse 13, a day comes when the sons and the daughters were eating and drinking in their eldest brother's house, and there comes a messenger unto Job and says, "The oxen were ploughing, the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped to tell thee." So Job now loses the sheep, the 7,000 sheep, the oxen and the asses. In verse 16, while he was yet speaking, there came also another, saying, "The fire of God is fallen from heaven and has burnt up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." And while he was yet speaking, verse 17 tells us of the three bands of Chaldeans that come down and slays the camels and the servants, but for the one that is allowed to escape. He has lost, therefore, his wealth, his employment, and the employment of those with him. And he has lost all that he has, materially speaking. But there is more to come, for such is Satan's hatred and judgment and jealousy. While he was yet speaking, verse 18, there came also another and said, "Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness, and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee." He had lost the sheep, the camels, the oxen, and the asses. He had lost many of his servants, and now he had lost his sons and his daughters. I wonder, brothers and sisters, how we would have reacted in that situation if we had lost our job, our form of employment, and those that we loved. There are times, are there not, in our own lives when we are forced to lose or to give up something and we don't understand why. There are situations when we are in darkness and cannot see the way forward. And sometimes there are things that happen to us and we never do understand why. Job's reaction here is the one that we also should show. Job arose, verse 20, and rent his mantle, and shaved his head, and fell down upon the ground, and worshipped, and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. Yahweh gave, and Yahweh hath taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh." In all this Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. It's hard, isn't it, brothers and sisters, sometimes to react in the right way. But Job doesn't question, he doesn't ask or question why God should do this to him. but through his faith and his strength he is able to continue. So much so that we are told that in all of this, through the fire, through the wind, through the Chaldean and the Sabian attacks, through all of that, he sinned not. What then would Satan's reaction be when on another day in chapter 2 sons of God again are presented, come to present themselves before Yahweh? And verse 2, from whence comest thou? And Satan answered and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down it. And Yahweh said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? For there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil, and still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause. You see, brothers and sisters, whether he had riches or they were taken away, whether he had a family or the family was taken away, mattered not. Job was the same man. Job 1 verse 1 and Job 2 verse 3 and 4. The same description is applied. Yet Satan hadn't understood. Satan answered Yahweh and said, verse 4, skin for skin. Yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth now thine hand, and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. Whatever it was that Job was to endure, whether it was believed it was a form of leprosy, or it says boiled, whatever illness, then we notice that Satan says that it would touch his bone and his flesh. The pain that Job would endure through the moments, through the days, however long that time period was not just like a flu or some virus or some illness that we might get that sort of isn't very significant. This illness would be powerful and hurtful. And so the Father, as it were, hands Job over to Satan. He is in thy hand, but spare his life. And so Satan went forth from the presence of Yahweh, and we see Job now smote with boils from the soles of his foot to the crown of his head, his body completely covered with boils, so much so that he scrapes himself in verse 8 and sits among the ashes. And his wife, the one whom the Father had arranged to become his wife and the one who was to be his aid, to be his helpmeet, turns to him in verse 9 and says, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. It would be an end to his suffering to simply curse God and to be struck dead. But he says to her, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speakers. What, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive also evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Hard to imagine, is it not, brothers and sisters, how someone can be so strong in the things of the truth, someone who can be so strong in the things for God, that he sins not with his lips through all of that suffering. We are meant to remember one who also suffered, one who suffered at the hand of men, one whom the Father allows them to take him and to crucify him, that he might have that perfect sacrifice offered unto himself. And we, brothers and sisters, are called to be like him. All things work together for good to them that love God. And so we see, brothers and sisters, the faith of this man Job. The book continues with the arguments and the discussions that take place, the debate as to why Job suffers in the way that he does. There's three friends who from verse 11 onwards of this chapter now come before him, base their arguments upon a belief that all suffering is a punishment of sin. Job is a great sufferer, therefore Job is a great sinner. And before we point the finger, brothers and sisters, there are times when we also believe that and say that to others. When brothers and sisters are enduring suffering and hardship and affliction, brothers and sisters, what is our reaction to them? Sometimes we can show the wrong attitude. And sometimes we can show the attitude that these three friends did. Eliphaz, his argument shows that Job must logically be a great sinner because of his great suffering. Bildad, his remarks are often cruel and cutting. He may have not meant them. He may have meant them to be helpful and to be encouraging, but they weren't. Instead, they were words that hurt. Zophar goes to the other extreme and suggests that Job's sufferings are really less, much less than he actually deserves. When in chapter 32 and through to 37 that we just read, Elihu comes onto the scene, Elihu very quickly draws attention to an important feature that has been missing from the arguments of Job and his friends. He emphasises the righteousness of God as opposed to the righteousness of man. Righteousness is imputed onto us. It was the righteousness of God rather than the righteousness of Job that needed to be upheld. And as one commentator has so beautifully put it concerning this suffering of Job, he says suffering was often intended not so much to prove a man as to improve him. The Father chasteneth whom he loveth. And it must have been right for Job to suffer, because we see that Job never changed. In fact, more so, we read that Job's character was strengthened in the early part of chapter 2. That despite what the Father had brought upon him as a result of the request of Satan, Job was still perfect and upright. He showed to the ultimate the strength of his faith. And the Father needed to see that from Job. And more so did Satan. There have, I know, been many discussions on the identity of Satan. And I know that there may be many here who will disagree with the comments that I'm going to make, but I just want to make a few general comments. I personally don't believe that Satan was anyone identified in the book of Job. It couldn't have been, I don't think, a son or daughter of Job, as some have suggested, because they were dead when God in chapter 2 asked Satan to reconsider. I don't believe it could have been Bildad, Zophar or Eliphaz, because chapter 2 verse 11 suggests that when they come on the scene, they weren't aware of what was going on, and they would have been had any of them, or all three of them, been his Satan. The suggestion has been made that it was his wife, because in verse 9, when she tells Job to curse God and die, they are very similar to Satan's words. But Satan clearly in the Hebrew is identified as masculine and not feminine. I don't believe that it was Elihu, because when Elihu comes on the scene, he is angry at Job's reaction. It's not what he expected, it's not what he wanted, and it certainly didn't tie in with the thoughts of Satan earlier on. We're not told who Satan was, and therefore maybe it doesn't matter who he was, but maybe there's also another lesson there for us. We do know from chapter 1 of Job, verse 6, that Satan was the son of God. He was therefore a brother of Job in the truth, as we would term it today. We know from verse 6 that he dwelt amongst them, and in verse 7 that he was walking up and down and to and fro through the earth. So if we take it at its literal, then we see a gathering together of brethren, amongst whom were Job and another one termed as Satan, and those two brethren are brought together before the Father. And when the one is asked to consider the other, his reaction is such that he is judgmental, and wrongfully so. But maybe, brothers and sisters, Satan repented. Maybe Satan did consider at the end that Job's faith was such that he should copy that example. And maybe that's why Satan's true identity is hidden from us, as the Father hides the identity of that one who was so responsible for that which fell upon Job. There is a lesson, of course, a very severe lesson for all of us, brothers and sisters, in our dealings one with the other. In the way that we look and judge, are quick to point the finger, love to bring somebody down, the influences of the world round about. But let's take some more exhortation then from this book of Job. Will you come with me, please, to chapter 25. The words of Bildad the Shuhite, Verse 2, dominion and fear are with him. He maketh peace in his high places. Is there any number of his armies? And upon whom doth not his light arise? How then can man be justified with God? Or how can he be clean that is born of a woman? Behold, even to the moon, and it shineth not. Yet the stars are not pure in his sight. How much less man that is a worm, and the son of man which is a worm? It's sometimes it says that we don't all know Hebrew, in the sense that we could read that in Hebrew, because I understand that the two worms there are different. The worm in the first part of verse 6 is the worm that eats away at a human body when it decays. The second worm is the cochineal worm that was crushed and trodden underfoot for its red dye. Man is corrupt and eaten by that worm. The son of man, on the other hand, made himself a worm, made himself of no reputation, as Psalm 22 says, "Behold, I am a worm and no man." And if we go to Job chapter 19, then our thoughts upon that worm, upon the mortality that we bear, are brought to light as we now consider that which was such to make Job so strong in the things of the truth. And when we endure difficulty and hardship in the truth, and when we strive to serve our master, then perhaps Job's words in chapter 19, and if we're going from verse 8 onwards, help us. He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass. He hath set darkness in my path. The future seems dark to Job, and there doesn't seem to be a light at the end of it. In Daniel chapter 2, similar words are expressed by Daniel in his prayer to the Father. If we just quickly turn to Daniel chapter 2. Father had revealed to him the dream that had been given to Nebuchadnezzar concerning the image, and he had received an understanding as to what it was that it spoke of. And in verse 22 of Daniel chapter 2, Daniel says of the Father, "He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him." You see, Benson says there are moments in our walk towards the truth, in the truth, when we have to walk through that valley of the shadow of death, when we have to walk through periods of darkness, and we cannot see the right way to go. And yet the light dwelleth with the Father, and therefore if we trust him, as Job was to do, then he will guide us through that darkness, for he knoweth what is in that darkness. And the light dwells with him. And it goes for every day of our life, brothers, in the darkness of this Gentile age. But there are times when we will not know which way to go, and we therefore have to put our trust in the Father. And so Job says, "He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass. He hath set darkness in my path. He hath stripped me of my glory and hath taken the crown from my head." And that crown there is the diadem. It's the royal crown. And the suggestion is that as this great man of the children of the East, Job would have worn a crown, and therefore suggests that his power was perhaps higher than we might have thought. "He hath destroyed me on every side, and I am gone. And my hope hath he removed like a tree. He hath also kindled his wrath against me. He counteth me unto him as one of the enemies. His troops come together and raise up their way against me and encamp round about my tabernacle. He hath put my brethren far from me. My acquaintance are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed. My familiar friends have forgotten me. They that dwell in mine house, my maids, count me for a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. I called my servant and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. My breath is strange to my wife. So I entreated for the children's sake of mine own body. Yea, young children despise me. I arose and they spake against me. All my inner friends abhorred me. They whom I loved are turned against me. My bone cleaveth to my skin and to my flesh, and I am escaped with the skin of my teeth. Have pity upon me. Have pity upon me, O ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do ye persecute me as God, and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book." Such was Job's faith. And such was Job's feelings in this time of trial and difficulty, that he wished and desired that they might be written in a book. And this book of Job, that sometimes may confuse us, sometimes we may find hard, was allowed and put on record that we might understand the thoughts and the motives of this man, that we might consider his faith. And in so doing, we see, do we not, the one we have meant to remember, who also was alone at the end, save for his father. His familiar friends, his disciples, one by one had left him, until he was alone. Verse 24, they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. You see, he knew that his Redeemer lived. His Redeemer lives forever. And that he knew that even if he died, even if his life was to be taken, that last thing that he had now held on to, it would not matter. For there would be a resurrection from the dead. There would be a glorious raising, and at the seat of judgment, the merciful hand of the Father, there would be a place in the kingdom. And James said, when you consider the suffering and the patience of Job, consider also the end. And in chapter 42, we have the end of Job, the end of this man. This man whose faith in the Redeemer, in the redeeming work of God through his Son, this one who through all that suffering was able still to be perfect and upright before his God, in chapter 42 and verse 1, now offers a prayer to the Father. I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. He had learned then that God was in control of his life and in all things in the earth. Do we, brothers and sisters? We see the Father's hand moving nations of the earth towards Armageddon. We see the miracles that are being performed throughout all the nations of the earth. And yet do we see those that are being worked in our own lives? Do we see the hand of God? Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. The humility of Job now, as he reverences this word of life, the thoughts and the knowledge and the understanding of the Father. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. It is so easy to read and to understand, much harder to apply the word of life. And Job says, now I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. And when he considered what he was, he abhorred himself. He repented in dust and ashes. And it is only then that he can now become the mediator between the Father and these three friends. These three friends who required that they might approach the Father. It was so after these words that the Father says to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Job hath. Therefore take you now seven bullocks and seven rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, if you have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. And so now they must come to Job, and he will now offer the prayer to the Father. And Job receives the end of the matter, the mercy of God. But through his faith, and because he was faithful, now is given to him twice as much as he had before. Twice as many sheep, twice as many oxen, twice as many of each. And in verse 13, he also received seven sons and three daughters. Not double, perhaps. But maybe that's because the ten that he first had, when they were resurrected, together with these ten, will give him a double portion also in the children. His life also is doubled. He lives 140 years. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. When the Apostle Paul came to write of those men and women of faith, it might appear that Job was not included. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. How alike then are the suffering of the saints? And sometimes we feel that we may suffer, be the only ones who suffer in the way that we do. But here Paul seems to share the same kind of suffering as did Job. Verse 7 of 2 Corinthians 12. And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly therefore will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities or weaknesses, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I made strong. And so Hebrews 11. See, Bernard says, we too should be made weak by the sufferings of the flesh and by its infirmities, to a stage where we acknowledge in humility and in humbleness that God is our everlasting strength. Hebrews 11, verse 33. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the enemies of the aliens. Job certainly was made strong out of weakness, and so too should we be. And so, brothers and sisters, having considered Job, perhaps we now too can be strengthened that however dark our trials and difficulties may be, the Father is there to guide us through them. And we are meant to remember another man who was made weak, that he might be strong. Another who at the end of his life was alone, save for his father. His mother, his disciples, his brethren, betrayed, rejected, unable to assist. Another who suffered the flesh, who suffered the pain of this life, that the flesh might die. Our desires, brothers and sisters, our passions and our lusts for this life must be removed, so that the only will that we have left is the will to serve the Lord our God with all our heart and with all our mind. Let us remember him then now as we break bread and drink wine. Pray God for the last time that our next might be with him in his kingdom. And let us, like Job, not only say it, but let us believe it in our hearts, that we might even be prepared to die for the truth when we say that we know that our Redeemer lives, and that he shall stand at the last day upon the earth, and though our bodies might be destroyed by the mortality that we bear, we know that we shall stand before him. And may it be that in that day, in that moment, we might so strive to serve him, that we might so endure the afflictions and the sufferings, the weakness of the flesh, that we might be made strong in him, we might be given that gift of immortality, we might rule and reign with him forever. And so let us now remember him until he comes. Thank you.